What if misreading a single line of poetry, didn't just mean you failed a literature class?
Right, which is bad enough.
Yeah, exactly. But what if it literally sparked a centuries-old theological crisis, like leading to accusations of full-blown heresy?
It's pretty wild to think about.
It really is. And today we are taking a deep dive into a fierce ancient philosophical debate within Judaism. It's all about how to read ancient texts and, well, how those very texts shape our most fundamental understanding of what God actually is.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable debate. It kind of forces you to look at the architecture of how human beings attempt to describe, the indescribable. I mean, the friction between poetry, philosophy, and mysticism here is just palpable.
Absolutely. And to guide us, our grounding material today is a highly passionate, honestly, very charged theological article. It was written by Chen Shaoluo and published in June 2026 on the site Mishpatav LeNegdi.
Right, and our mission with this piece is to explore this dramatic clash. It's a clash between strict rationalist philosophy, so think along the lines of the great 12th century philosopher Maimonides.
Maimonides.
Yes, exactly. Him on one side, and then on the other side, the mystical Kabbalistic texts, specifically the Zohar.
And we're really going to look at what this clash means for you, for anyone engaged in the pursuit of wisdom. But right up front, I need to make a very clear disclaimer to you listening.
Yeah, this is important.
Definitely. The source material we're using contains heavily charged, very strong theological opinions and critiques. So our mission today is strictly to explore and understand the author's arguments without taking any sides.
There you
We
go.
certainly aren't endorsing any of the viewpoints we discuss.
We're just impartial guides on this journey.
Exactly, just the guide.
Because we're mapping out a very intense intellectual and spiritual argument here. We're looking at the structural load-bearing walls of two vastly different worldviews.
Okay, let's unpack this. How does a simple love poem spark a theological crisis?
Well, the inciting incident for this entire debate rests on a single, very famous biblical verse.
Right.
It's the opening of King Solomon's Song of Songs, chapter 1, verse 2, which goes, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth."
I mean, on its face, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth sounds like pure romantic poetry.
Oh, absolutely.
It's sensual, right? It evokes a very human, very physical image.
And that very human image is exactly where the author of our source material, taking this strict rationalist view, plants his flag.
Okay.
The rationalist argument is that Solomon's poetry was always intended to be a pure, elevated allegory.
A metaphor.
Yes, a metaphor for the human intellect's immense, overwhelming desire for wisdom and for the Torah. The stance here is that Solomon is simply comparing the sweetness of intellectual truth to the strongest human emotion we can possibly relate to.
Which is romantic love.
Exactly.
So it's like the ultimate poetic device. You take something incredibly abstract, the pure intellectual pursuit of ultimate truth, and you map it onto something deeply visceral and human.
Right, so our limited human brains can actually grasp the intensity of that pursuit.
Because we all understand longing. So the text uses longing to explain the quest for knowledge.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is how the author takes this rationalist foundation and uses it to fiercely critique the mystical tradition, specifically targeting the Zohar, which is, a foundational text of Kabbalah.
Okay, so what's the critique?
Well, the author claims that the Zohar takes this poetic kiss and strips away the metaphor entirely. Like it literalizes it into a highly complex system of divine mating.
Wait, I have to stop you there. Divine mating.
Yeah.
Because that is quite a leap from an allegory about pursuing intellectual wisdom. What does that actually mean in the context of the Zohar?
So according to the author's reading of the text, the Zohar describes spirit as clinging and maps out a literal family of divine faces or entities. These are concepts known in Kabbalah as Zir Anpin and the Shekinah.
Hold on, you're going to have to explain those terms to me like I'm five. Because what are Zir Anpin and Shekinah? I imagine most people don't use those words in everyday conversation.
Fair enough, yeah. So in Kabbalistic mysticism, the infinite unknowable God is thought to interact with the universe through different emanations or facets.
Like different expressions of the divine.
Exactly. So Zir Anpin roughly translates to the lesser countenance or the small face, and it's often associated with the masculine active principles of the divine.
Okay, got it.
And then the Shekinah is often described as the feminine receptive divine presence, the part that dwells in the physical world.
Right. So where does the kiss come in?
Well, the author argues that the Zohar interprets the kiss in Song of Songs not as a human desiring wisdom, but as an actual mechanical interaction between these masculine and feminine divine entities.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it involves descriptions of lips, breath, kissing. It's interpreted as a sort of cosmic coupling within the divine realm itself.
And here is where the author starts throwing out accusations of idolatry.
Huge accusations, yes.
The argument is that by introducing physical attributes and like gender dynamics and multiple faces into a singular formless god, the Zohar is essentially adopting a Christian-like theology of multiplicity.
Yeah, that's the author's view, yes.
He views this as an incredibly dangerous corruption. And again, to you listening, we are just reporting the author's fierce stance here, but the heat of this argument is intense.
Extremely intense. I mean, the author feels that giving God physical attributes, even if they're framed as mystical secrets or higher realm realities, completely destroys the foundational Jewish concept of a unified, non-physical creator.
Right.
Once you introduce parts, mechanics, and genders into God, you're no longer talking about the infinite first cause. You're talking about a cosmic mythology.
To put this in perspective, it's almost like imagine reading a beautiful sci-fi novel about the indomitable human spirit.
Okay.
And someone else comes along and insists on using that novel as a literal instruction manual to build a spaceship engine.
That's a great way to put it.
If we read poetry as an anatomy manual for the divine, don't we lose the poetry entirely?
You do.
And more importantly, according to the author, we lose the pure concept of God because we've reduced the infinite down to a blueprint with moving parts.
Exactly. Because if you turn the poetry into a mechanical blueprint of the heavens, you fundamentally change the mechanics of the religion itself.
So true.
And to understand why the author is so opposed to these physical metaphors, we have to look at how true connection to the divine is actually achieved in this rationalist framework.
Which brings us to Maimonides.
Yes. We have to look at Maimonides and his monumental work, The Guide for the Perplexed.
Maimonides, the 12th century philosopher, physician, and absolute giant of medieval rationalist thought.
Yeah, the author relies heavily on Maimonides to establish that true connection to God isn't physical.
Right.
And honestly, it isn't even emotional in the way we usually conceive of religious ecstasy. It is purely 100% intellectual.
But wait, a purely intellectual connection sounds, I don't know, incredibly dry?
It does sound that way to us today, sure.
Because we are so conditioned to chase spiritual feelings or emotional highs or these mystical experiences, how does a purely intellectual connection even work?
Okay, think of it like a radio transmission.
A radio transmission, okay.
Maimonides ties the human intellect directly to the concept of divine providence, which is the idea of God's protection or care over a person.
Right.
But providence isn't like a guy sitting on a cloud pulling levers to reward or punish you.
Right. It's not a transaction.
No. Providence is a constant signal broadcasting across the universe. And your intellect is the antenna.
Oh, I see.
So the protection or connection you experience is directly, causally tied to how perfectly your intellect is tuned to the frequency of truth.
So divine protection isn't arbitrary, it's a mechanism.
A literal mechanism, yeah.
The more you focus your mind on ultimate truth, the stronger the signal comes in.
Exactly. And the source details three specific states of the human mind to really illustrate how this mechanism works.
Okay, let's go through them.
So the first state is total darkness.
Total darkness.
This is a person who simply hasn't thought of God or ultimate truth at all. Their intellect is completely disengaged.
So their antenna is just broken or turned off entirely.
Exactly. They are just wandering in the dark, completely subjected to the randomness of the physical universe, basically because they aren't catching the signal.
Wow. Okay, what's the second state?
The second state is described like a cloudy day.
A cloudy day.
Yeah. This is the person who knows God, who understands the truth, but, you know, their attention wavers. They get distracted by the mundane physical things of life.
Which happens to all of us.
Right. So the light of the sun is there, the signal is broadcasting, but there are clouds blocking it. The connection flickers in and out based on their level of distraction.
Which implies the third state is the ideal.
Bright sunlight.
Bright sunlight.
This is the perfect person whose intellect is constantly and intensely attached to God and truth. They're standing directly in the unclouded light of the sun.
So their antenna is perfectly tuned.
Perfectly, receiving maximum providence, meaning their mind is so aligned with the reality of the universe that they navigate it flawlessly.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because this completely redefines the age-old philosophical problem of theodicy.
Right, the question of why bad things happen to good people.
Exactly. The author, channeling Maimonides here, explores the concept of the hiding of the face.
Yes.
When a tragedy strikes or bad things happen, it's not because God suddenly changed his mind or got angry or decided to punish someone.
No, because if we connect this to the bigger picture, God is entirely unchanging in this philosophy. The sun is always shining. The broadcast never stops.
So what causes the hiding of the face?
It happens because the person became distracted. They stepped out of the sunlight. They allowed their mind to wander to the physical temporal world. And in doing so, they created their own barrier of ignorance.
Wow.
The protection faded because the physical world is inherently chaotic, and they just stopped tuning into the order of the divine intellect.
So we build our own cloud.
We build our own clouds.
That's incredibly profound. And the author points out a fascinating distinction Maimonides makes between love and passion.
Right. The Hebrew word for passion there is tsheshek.
Tsheshek. Because love is a connection, but it still implies two separate entities having a relationship. Passion, at least in this highly specific philosophical context, is the absolute peak intellectual flow state.
Yes, flow state is a great modern term for it.
It's when the mind is so deeply locked onto the truth that it can focus on literally nothing else. It's not a swooning emotional romance.
Not at all.
It is an intense, laser-focused intellectual obsession where the thinker and the thought almost become one.
And that intellectual obsession brings us right back to the debate over the word kiss.
Ah.
Because if connection to God is purely intellectual, without any physical or emotional blending, how do we explain a very famous concept in rabbinic literature? The concept of death by a kiss.
Wait, I have a major question about this.
Go for it.
If the author and Maimonides are so terrified of using physical metaphors for God, why did the ancient rabbis use a highly physical, sensual word like kiss to describe the deaths of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam?
It seems like a contradiction, right?
It really does.
Yeah.
Doesn't using that word invite the exact mystical misinterpretation they are trying to fight against?
This raises an important question. And it's where Maimonides performs an incredible piece of philosophical redefinition.
What does he do?
He acknowledges the term kiss, but he completely strips it of its physical meaning. When Moses, Aaron, and Miriam died by a kiss, it was absolutely not a physical touch.
Okay.
It wasn't a mystical joining of spiritual bodies or divine entities mating in the heavens.
Then what is the mechanism? I mean, how does an intellectual flow state cause death?
It's the ultimate consequence of that passion we just discussed. It's the moment the soul reaches the absolute ultimate peak of intellectual joy and comprehension of truth. The human mind reaches such a state of perfect, unbroken focus on the reality of God that the soul simply outgrows its need for the physical body. It just detaches.
That's intense.
So the kiss is merely a poetic placeholder word for the ultimate intellectual climax. It's where the mind is so consumed by truth that the physical body simply ceases to function.
It's the ultimate mind-blown moment.
Exactly.
The brain understands the universe so perfectly that it just unplugs from the hardware.
That's a great way to visualize it.
Now, I notice a fascinating textual discrepancy in the author's argument regarding Miriam's death.
Yes. The precision of the biblical text regarding her death is incredibly revealing for the rationalist argument.
So the tradition states all three, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, died by a kiss. But in the actual text of the Torah for Moses and Aaron, it says they died by the mouth of God.
Right.
Yet for Miriam, the text deliberately leaves out that phrase. It just says she died.
And why is that?
Well, the author explains that the biblical text was hyper careful to avoid any sensual misunderstanding. Because Miriam was a woman, the text omitted the word mouth so that no one could possibly, even for a fraction of a second, interpret it as a literal, physical, romantic encounter between a human female and a divine male entity.
Yeah, it really demonstrates how terrified the rationalist tradition is of physicalizing God, and how carefully the texts were written to prevent human imagination from running wild.
Yikes.
And the author brings in another major thinker to cement this exact point, Rabbi David Kimchi, known as Radak.
And Radak is absolutely uncompromising on this topic.
Completely uncompromising.
He lays down a hard, unbreakable rule regarding allegory.
He does. So he is commenting on Psalms 45, and he insists that one cannot use terms of explicit sexual intimacy for God, even as a metaphor.
Not even as a metaphor.
No. He points to the Hebrew word shagal, which translates roughly to a consort or a queen who shares the king's bed. Radak says you cannot use that imagery for the divine, period.
Because the human mind is too fragile.
Exactly. The human mind is too fragile, too easily swayed by physical imagery.
So even if you put a giant disclaimer on the text saying, hey, this is just a metaphor for intellectual pursuit, Radak says no.
He says no.
The sheer act of visualizing a divine consort corrupts the mind. It pulls you out of the sunlight and drops you right into the mud of physicality.
And what's fascinating here is how the author synthesizes Radak's rule to deliver a devastating blow to the Zohar.
Okay, let's hear the synthesis.
The author argues if Radak states that even a simple metaphor of intimacy is strictly forbidden because it pollutes human cognition, then the Zohar's explicit, complex system of divine mating is completely out of bounds.
All the masculine and feminine energies, the physical kisses in the heavens.
It's all out of bounds. Mm-hmm. The rationalist view is that God is perfect, singular, and whole. God doesn't need fixing through our mystical actions, and there are no fractured divine faces that need to be reunited.
Humans are the broken ones. We are the ones fractured by our physical existence, and the only way to fix ourselves is by clarifying our intellect and pointing our antenna toward the truth.
Which brings us to the application of this philosophy.
Right, because we've spent a lot of time in the 12th century.
We have.
Discussing high-level theology, Maimonides, and medieval biblical commentary. But the author takes this entire philosophical framework and drops it directly into the reality of our daily lives.
He really does.
So, what does this all mean for you and me right now? The author takes this 800-year-old philosophy of the intellect and applies it to modern habits.
And it's pretty convicting.
It is. It's not just a critique of ancient mysticism. It's a critique of how we spend our Tuesday nights.
Right. So the author asks, what happens when we voluntarily fill our minds with vanity?
Okay.
He argues that spending hours consuming empty entertainment, endlessly watching sports, scrolling through movies, or just absorbing mindless media is not merely a bad habit. It's not just a way to blow off steam.
Under this Maimonidean philosophy, it is a literal spiritual hazard.
It actively severs your connection to divine providence.
Because, going back to the radio analogy, protection and connection are directly tied to the frequency your intellect is tuned to.
Exactly.
If you are watching a ball game for 6 hours, your intellect is not in the sunlight of truth. You have intentionally turned off the receiver.
You've walked into the dark, or at best, you've pulled dense clouds over your own head.
And the author grounds this in a very recognizable psychological reality. I mean, think about that hollow feeling you get after a massive binge of mindless media.
It's incredibly relatable.
You sit on the couch, you binge watch a show, or you scroll through a social media feed for 3 hours. While it's happening, you feel occupied. Your brain is full of noise, colors, and rapid-fire stimuli.
Sure.
But the second you lock your phone screen or turn off the TV, you don't feel rested. You feel hollow, lethargic, and strangely empty.
And the author asks us to consider why we feel that way. According to this philosophy, it's because you stepped out of the sunlight. You filled your mind with static information that contains no ultimate truth, no intellectual weight, and no connection to the divine reality.
You fed your intellect phantom calories.
Phantom calories. Mm. The entertainment tricked your brain into thinking it was engaged, but it left your soul entirely empty because the connection to providence was severed.
It's a neurochemical reality that Maimonides basically predicted 800 years before smartphones even existed.
What's somebody saying?
He understood the crash that comes from passive, non-intellectual noise. But, you know, I think it's crucial to point out that this isn't a demand that everyone must become a monk.
Oh, definitely not.
You don't have to sit in a library staring at philosophy books 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
We all have jobs, bills, and physical responsibilities.
And the author is very careful to make that distinction. He explicitly defends the sanctity of honest work.
Right.
Engaging in mundane tasks, building a house, running a business, dealing with the real world, does not inherently distance you from the truth.
Provided your mind is ultimately oriented toward wisdom.
Exactly. If you are working ethically, providing for your family, keeping your moral compass true, you are still in the sunlight. You are actively engaging with the reality of the universe.
So it's about the orientation of your intellect, not necessarily the specific physical task your hands are doing.
That's right.
Active, meaningful engagement with the world keeps the antenna tuned. Passive, mindless consumption breaks it.
Well said.
I see this as the ultimate ancient productivity hack. Mindless scrolling isn't just procrastinating on a deadline. According to this worldview, it's a literal barrier between you and a higher reality.
It really frames the physical distractions of our world, not just as annoyances, but as the clouds that block the sun.
Yeah.
By actively choosing the noise, we are choosing to remove ourselves from the providence that comes with clear intellectual focus.
Okay, let's briefly recap the journey we just took. We started with a fierce debate over how to read a single line of King Solomon's love poetry, whether it is an allegory for intellectual desire or a literal map of divine mystical intimacy.
Right.
That brought us to Maimonides' profound theory that our connection to the divine is purely intellectual, a radio signal of unclouded sunlight.
Yes.
And finally, that translated into a stark warning about the spiritual and psychological cost of our daily modern distractions.
And just to offer a final neutrality check here, while the author's stance against the mystical traditions is incredibly uncompromising, the beauty of a deep dive like this is exploring the profound, often conflicting ways humanity has tried to understand the unknowable.
Absolutely.
The rationalist builds a radio tower of the intellect. The mystic draws a map of divine energies. Both are attempting to bridge the gap between human limitation and infinite truth.
We are just looking at the blueprints the author provided for us today. And as we wrap up, I want to hand it over to you for a final thought. We've talked a lot about the fragility of human attention and Maimonides' ideal of pure, unbroken intellectual focus. What does this mean for our future?
Well, I want you to ponder a concept that builds on the author's critique of our modern attention economy, but takes it into the realm of technology.
Okay, where are we going with this?
So the author argues that filling your mind with vanity and distractions separates you from truth. Maimonides states that a human being naturally fluctuates like a cloudy day, losing connection due to our biology and our physical needs.
Right.
But what happens when we create artificial intelligence?
Oh, wow.
An AI doesn't get distracted by sports, it doesn't need to sleep, and it doesn't have physical urges. If an artificial mind can be programmed to sustain a pure, unbroken, absolute intellectual focus on ultimate truth without ever generating a cloud of distraction, does it achieve a higher state of Maimonidean and divine connection than a human being ever could?
That is something to think about. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive and for taking the time to tune your intellect with us today, and we'll see you next time.